So That Happened is sponsored by Volvo. Experience the wonder of summer. Have a month's payment on Volvo and spend your summer doing the things that matter to you. Plus, get up to 5 years full coverage, including wear and tear. Go to volvocars.com/US.
This podcast contains explicit language.
We're meeting with Wisconsin Democrat Representative... Sorry.
That was good.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. I felt it was inferior. I felt it was below par. Wasn't up to my normal standard.
Subprime, you might say.
It was very subprime. It was very subprime. I'm already securitizing my shitty hosting duties, so that's cool. So That Happened. This week, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren put forward an ambitious and bipartisan plan to bring much-needed reform and accountability to our higher education industry. She joins us today to talk about this and other matters pertaining to your money and your life. And speaking of higher education, author Lee Siegel wrote an op-ed this past Sunday for the New York Times in which he made the case that strategically defaulting on your student loan might be a good choice for those who've ended up yoked to bad jobs and bad loans in this economy. But is this fair to everyone who's faithfully paying down their education costs? We will kick the tires on Siegel's argument. And finally, we are once again back on that Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. And this time, we're joined by Wisconsin Democratic Representative Mark Pocan to get the latest on this ongoing melodrama. I'm Jason Linkins, today with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Arthur Delaney. And here's what happened first.
Hello.
Senator Warren, thank you so much for joining us today on our podcast. This week, you laid out a plan to reform higher education, much needed area of reform. It largely seeks to sort of unify both parties around some important interests. For Democrats, it brings greater affordability to more students. And for Republicans, it brings greater accountability to institutions to take taxpayer dollars. We're going to put your plan and your speech in its entirety on the Huffington Post Politics Tumblr for our listeners. But I wanted to ask today about current policy and current policymakers, because in your discussion, you talk a lot about the Corinthian College scandal. You talk a lot about Arne Duncan, whose response to the Corinthian College scandal in getting resolution for the people who got rooked by Corinthian. It took some criticism in some places. I want to ask, does Arne Duncan have to go before there's real reform that can happen?
No, I think the key is that the Department of Education needs to get out there and do its job on behalf of our students. They don't work for Navient. They don't work for the for-profit colleges. They don't work for the debt servicers. They work for the American people, and they work for our kids who are trying to get an education and trying to pay off their student loan debts. You know, I do want to say that Secretary Duncan has just announced that with Corinthian, they're going to put together a way to treat a whole class of students who were cheated and deal with their debts, forgive their debts as quickly as possible. And that is a really good first step. But it's important to keep the pressure on, because there are a whole lot more people who were cheated by Corinthian, and we want to see what the procedures are going to be for helping them out. At this moment, I'm hopeful.
When you say keep the pressure on, though, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in your speech from Wednesday about accountability, particularly for colleges, for universities themselves. I mean, I think you can look back on the Department of Education's record on this, and Arne Duncan has been on siding against the student advocates again and again and again on just about every issue, and then eventually has to be pulled around to the side that student advocates are talking about. Do you really think that he's the best guy for the job right now?
No. What I think is exactly what I said in the speech, that the only way we're going to have a higher ed system that works is if we have a lot more accountability in it. And that means accountability for the colleges, and it means more accountability for the Department of Education. The Department of Education needs to be out there for our students, not working for the big debt companies, not working for the loan servicers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think this is a really interesting speech, but I'm always very skeptical about economic arguments about inequality that focus on education and especially higher education, because I just think, you know, we all kind of know that the value of going to, let's say, a place like a Harvard or a Yale isn't that you get access to some, like, secret mysteries that people who go to James Madison University or who go to the public library, like, can't access. It's that you get to say you went to Harvard or Yale. I sort of think of it as just, like, this elite signaling game for members of the you know, the
keeping in
classes.
Mind that both of us went to elite colleges,
right. I mean,
we like to signal.
So I mean, is it a...
Say,
go ahead.
Brian, you do know you're talking to a graduate from the University of Houston, don't you? Could you watch your mouth on this? Because what I want to be clear about is that college opens doors. It opens lots of doors. And I don't kid myself about there are lots of differences, lots of opportunities that some kids get and others don't. But let's talk about the basics, and that is getting in the door and getting a chance to get a college diploma and to be able to do it without being crushed by debt. And that's where we should talk about federal policy, because that's where federal policy makes a real difference. We have two major problems right now in the system, and it has driven the system toward costs that are just out of control. You know, keep in mind that 3 out of 4 college students today are in public universities, but they're paying far more than they did a generation ago. Adjusted for inflation, somebody going to college today to a state university is paying about 300% of what her mom or dad paid just 30 years ago.
Are they still getting the bang for the buck for that money, though?
Absolutely. They need to go to college, but that's the problem. When they load up on debt, that then has profound implications both for the student and for the economy at large. And that's where part of the problem is. We need college grants, but the debt is holding them back, and it's holding us back. They can't buy cars. They're not buying homes. They're not starting small businesses. They're not making the purchases that we would expect them to make at this point in their lives, the ones that keep this economy rolling forward. You know, I look at it this way. Degrees push this economy forward. Debt pulls it back. So we need to make changes at the federal level that address both halves of that, how we make college more affordable and how we reduce the amount of debt that students have to take on in order to get there.
Well, when you talk about debt, I mean, it's interesting because sometimes community bankers who have a lot of times been against a lot of reforms to the financial system have started to say, well, you know, actually people aren't buying homes and mortgages. This is actually kind of hurting our bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't hear as much from some other more elite bankers. There's a guy, I don't know if you've heard of him. He works for a company called J.P. Morgan Chase. His name is Jamie Dimon. Have you heard of him? He's an obscure figure.
I have heard of him.
He said some stuff this week about you, and I just want to read you a quote. He said, "I don't know if she fully understands the global banking system." Was he mansplaining to you?
You know, the problem is not that I don't understand the global banking system. The problem for these guys is that I fully understand the system, and I understand how they make their money. And that's what they don't like about me.
Is it mansplaining if I say that I think he was mansplaining to you?
We'll have to call in a mansplaining expert to figure that one out.
We can find one maybe the next time we talk. But it's interesting. Do you think right now, we talk about people who understand the banking system, do you think right now our regulatory agencies proceed from the proper premises when they approach the banks themselves? You know, we've seen like a lot of top graduates from top schools go to Wall Street, and they're bringing this quantitative expertise. And I wonder if we're capable of matching that.
You know, you raise a really important and tough question, and that is, when you do regulations that wait until, you know, the bank invents something else in order to trick people or to take on more risk and shift it over to the taxpayers, and regulators are always 2 steps behind trying to figure it out, that one is a tough approach. And that's why when I did the speech, I don't know if you got a chance to see it, but the one I did for the Minsky Institute a couple of months ago, talking about the kinds of structural reforms we need, why we need structurally to take some of the risk out of the system, why it is that banking that is backed up by the taxpayers needs to be simpler and easier to follow. in part because that makes regulation easier. You know, every time these guys come in with these incredibly complicated banking structures and subs, mm-hmm. you know, cross guarantees and reverse repos and a zillion different things that they're trying to do under the umbrella of a federally guaranteed bank. When they try to do that, what they're and then they come in and complain about, whoa, regulations are tough and regulations are too complicated. And
right, exactly.
You say, hey, listen, guys, there's a way to fix that. If banking is boring, the regulatory part can be boring too. You want to get out there and take on risks? Okay, go do it. But don't do it within the structure of a bank that gets backed up by the federal government.
But even though under a simpler system, you still have to have regulators who actually care about enforcing simple rules. And one of the agencies you mentioned in that speech was the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yep.
And you sent a letter to SEC Chair Mary Jo White last week. That was, I think, was interpreted as being a pretty intense letter. You said that she had not been a strong leader. A lot of the discussion around that letter concerned a meeting that you had with Mary Jo White. Someone from the SEC called and told me that you had gotten the meeting all wrong. That Mary Jo White had always been committed to getting an important regulation done by the fall, and that you had misrepresented her statements. What happened in that meeting, and what do you make of the scheduling on that rule?
Well, you know, look, Mary Jo White was very clear that she was going to get this rule done in the next month or two. She said nothing was going to hold it past the fall. And then, you know, it turns out that the SEC gave itself a whole lot more room to be able to finish this rule up. But, you know, can we just stop and remember the context of this? They originally announced this rule would be done in 2013. Then they announced it would be done in 2014.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it was going to be done in 2015. And now they're saying, hey, 2016, trust us on this. You can see why, at this point, some people might be just a little bit skeptical and running out of patience.
Yeah. Well, speaking of skepticism and patience, there's another big area. I guess it's this week. There's a vote. It's scheduled for Friday. So by the time this interview actually runs, we'll know what happened with the vote on this. But it's on the fast track authority for President Obama. You guys have exchanged some words over that bill over the past couple of weeks. At one point, I was on a conference call with the president, and he was very clear. He was talking about you. And he said that your arguments had been, quote, dishonest, unquote, that they had been misleading, that you were manipulating the base. It's interesting to me. There's a new rider attached to the fast track bill, which says fast track can't deal with any environmental issues related to trade, can't deal with environmental issues related to climate change. The president's been going around saying that this bill is going to have strong environmental protections. Is the president, does he have an integrity problem on TPP?
Look, I believe that TPP could give too much multinational corporations and not be a good deal for America's working families. This is not personal. I have gone back and forth with the president about what I believe are the risks associated with this deal. I don't doubt President Obama's sincerity when he claims that this trade deal is going to be tough, that it's going to have unprecedented work protections for workers or for the environment. The problem is that we have heard near critical promises about trade agreements for more than 20 years now, from President Clinton, from President Bush, and from President Obama himself. In the real world, experience shows that those trade agreements have failed to curb the worst labor abuses in our partner countries. They have failed to meet the environmental goals. And so it's the reality. The question is not one of integrity. The question is one of what kind of risks should the American people take. And I don't think this is one we should take.
All right. Well, Senator Warren, thanks so much for talking to us today.
A lot of money or your life questions. We appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'd love to have you again.
All right. You bet.
Thanks very much. This podcast is sponsored by Volvo. It's time to experience the wonder of summer. Leave early, get close, wander more, stargaze, do it all. Have a month's payment on Volvo and spend your summer doing the things that matter to you. Plus, get up to 5 years full coverage, including wear and tear. The Wonder of Summer event from Volvo. Go to volvocars.com/US or test drive a Volvo at your local dealer. Hi, we're back. We're going to continue to talk about higher education. I'm joined right now by our Shadrack lineup of Zach Carter.
Ayo.
And Arthur Delaney.
Arthur Delaney.
Yeah, so here's what I wanted to talk about today. Author Lee Siegel. He wrote an op-ed for the New York Times Magazine, in which he lays out the case for strategic default. He had student loans. He found himself in a situation where he could work a bunch of jobs that took him away from what he wanted to do in life and pay off the loan and not get further down his career. Or he can make the choice to default on his student loan, face the consequences for that, and then move forward doing what he wanted to do under the shadow of whatever those consequences was. He went on CNBC to defend his position. Let's take a listen to that.
People out there that have worked very hard going to school and then have taken on jobs so they can pay it back.
Yes.
You don't think it is completely unfair to all those people who actually pay their loan that you're just saying, screw it?
I'm not saying screw it, and I did not say that to myself. I did not say that I refused to pay my loans, and I never took them out with the intention. I said that I did not take a job or go into the army or do anything like that in order to pay off my loans. I decided that I would become what I wanted to become, and I went into default, and I suffered because of that. But I do think that for me, that was a better choice than having to go harness myself in a job or three jobs to pay off a loan that I found pointless and overbearing.
So, okay, that was Wall Street bootblack Andrew Ross Sorkin inquiring after Lee Siegel's strategic default decision.
I've never heard the term bootblack used as an insult before, especially against like a man who makes a lot of money being on television.
It worked, Jason. That was clever. Good.
Thank you.
So Lee Siegel is the complaint here ignores what Lee Siegel continuously emphasizes, which is I suffer the consequences. And those consequences namely are you're not going to get another loan from this source. Your credit is going to be wrecked.
Right.
I mean, your ability
home
to
home buying, car buying,
Job taking, apartment getting, all kinds of things are negatively affected because everyone checks your credit these days,
yeah,
or at least lots of places do. So he suffered the consequences. It's not like nothing happened as
right.
a result of this.
Can we also just point out, like, when you take out a loan, that's not a gift from somebody. The person who gives you the loan is not doing you a favor. They are making a rational decision which they think they are going to profit from. And the risk when you extend a loan to somebody is that it will not get paid back. They do not have a right to making future profits on loans that they make. They are taking a risk. It is a rational decision that they are doing in their own self-interest. If you don't pay it back and the lender loses money, maybe they shouldn't have given you the loan. Maybe that should be priced in. The risk of default should be priced into how much loans actually cost.
Now, here's a better argument against this, which Siegel anticipated in the piece for the New York Times, which is by you doing this, you increase borrowing costs for other people.
Right. So that is what Andrew Ross Sorkin is getting at. What's to make of that?
Well, he's saying, you know, if everyone were to do this and the student lending system were to collapse, it would merely expose the farce that is higher education today. And it's one sentence in his piece, but it's a huge topic and a worthy one as somebody who has done higher education.
But look, this is how markets work, okay? If a lot of people just
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tried to change their behavior, a market is supposed to be able to respond. The only reason that you should be upset about that is if you think the people who are currently making a lot of money off of the student loan system as it currently operates need to continue to make a lot of money off of that system.
The federal government itself makes a lot of money off the student loan system.
I mean, there is an argument to be made that the Department of Education is a predatory lender right now, given how much money it makes and how much debt people are going into. I don't know.
I would make that argument. You know, the Department of Education is going after, like, elderly people and their spouses for loans that have long been, like, a done deal that they're not going to be able to pay off.
I mean, they certainly contract with lowlifes, with debt collectors, and with companies that they know have used predatory and deceptive tactics to try and get their loans repaid. But I just, you know, if everybody decides to stop paying their student loans and borrowing costs go way up, then, I mean, that would just show people that the existing system is designed to extract an enormous amount of money from people for something that just isn't that valuable. And I find the idea that he's a deadbeat and a bad example and stuff. There's some guy from Slate who wrote a response to this.
Jordan Weissman, the New York Times should apologize for the awful op-ed it just ran.
There's one good point that he makes.
Why should the New York Times apologize? That's such a dipshit thing to say.
It's just a, you know.
How dare you put an idea out into the world, well, Slate, of all people saying that? Come on.
I mean, but
Slate
but,
is doing Slate.
God damn.
Slate is being contrary, which is a known Slate habit. So,
but they're also
set that aside.
They should apologize for that fucking Creed article. How's that?
Whoa, apologize for cussing.
Sorry.
Slate did say that Creed was good a few years ago, and yeah, it was really bad.
Sorry, yeah. Zach. So you were about to respond to this.
He raises one point that I think is substantive in that whole piece, which is mostly just shaming this guy by saying, "Hey, you shouldn't have been a liberal arts major if you like wanted to have a real life," which I think is totally mean spirited, nasty thing to say, especially for someone who was a writer for Slate magazine. But the substantive point he makes that's not just trying to shame somebody for, like, having different interests than he may have had in college is where he says you can refinance your loans. Right now, that's an option that's available to people. So,
yeah, of course.
So you can refinance your loans. There are programs at the Department of Education that exist. Once they process your application, which is very difficult, there are a lot of people who have tried to do this and it takes forever. But the consequences of refinancing your loan tend to be much less severe for somebody than the consequences of just outright defaulting. There are limits right now from the Department of Education on, you know, how much you have to lose from each paycheck by refinancing. They can garnish your wages if you default on your student loans.
Yep, that's true.
And there's no bankruptcy, you know, process.
They made it harder to get out from under student loan debt through bankruptcy in a 2005 bankruptcy reform that the Bush
it's ridiculously hard to discharge a student loan through bankruptcy, whereas it's much, much easier for well-heeled people to declare bankruptcy, move on with their lives. People of great wealth find themselves seamlessly able to make these kind of decisions. And what these decisions are really, they come down to, is just a simple cost-benefit analysis. You look at your situation and say, well, I could do this to pay off my student loan and I would end up like that, or I could default and I'll end up like this. Weigh the two. Which is worse?
It's an entire business strategy.
Yeah,
that
I don't even
made Mitt Romney
right
the entrepreneur that he is.
Yeah.
Wealthy people can discharge mortgage debt from vacation homes in bankruptcy. You can't discharge student loan debts in bankruptcy effectively. And that distorts the market for student lending, because the threat of default is supposed to be something that's in there for the lender to take into account when they issue a loan. And when they don't have to worry about the threat of default, they can charge you anything they want because you have no choice but to pay it back. And they can, in this case, you know, they can even garnish your wages if you do default.
Right.
Well, there's a double standard that holds strategic default exists for business, and it's something that is an accepted practice. But when an individual decides not to pay back a student loan or a mortgage, it's moral.
The CNBC set had the same things to say about people who were underwater in their homes and said, fuck this, I'm walking away.
Yeah.
You know, when that was their best choice, rather than be, you know, tied to a failing mortgage for the rest of their lives, just go into default and try to scrape by with what's left of what you got. And it, again, they, it's like CNBC, of course, is like the high priestesses of the
capital.
Financial sector. So you wouldn't expect their delphinic oracles to say anything else. But I think that – I don't think anyone here is calling for everyone who has a student loan to default on it. I mean, I'm paying off a student loan, and I'm not going to default on it. But I think that it is a rational choice that some people can make. Some of these people who got screwed by Corinthian, these kids who paid out the waz for an education that literally – doesn't matter, was literal nonsense and crap. What are they going to do? No one's coming. I mean, we were just talking about how maybe Arne Duncan's going to put a package of debt relief together for them, but it may not go that far. And there are other kids who've been rooked by other for-profit institutions who are facing the same situation. And those institutions, they exist to do nothing more than turn you upside down and shake your pockets by the heels and take whatever money they can get from you.
They're not
getting anything in return. And so to punish, if no one's going to punish them, you got to find a way to walk away from it somehow. And strategic default might be the way for those kids to go.
And that is how markets work. If markets can't adapt to changing, you know, consumer behavior, then maybe the market's kind of bad and broken. Maybe you need to reform things. So the idea that this guy is somehow, I mean, essentially, here's what happens. When you are faced with a serious calamity every time, whether it's the housing bubble, whether it's the current student debt crisis, whether there are a lot of individuals who have too much debt, there is a certain class of people that likes to look at the people who have too much debt and say, you're a bad person for having too much debt. It has nothing to do with economics. It has nothing to do with markets. It's just about creating classes of people who are worthy and unworthy and shaming the people who are deemed to be
right.
morally
Right. You're morally inferior if you end up in debt.
Right. Whereas if you made a lot of money putting people into debts they can't pay back,
right.
you are a morally wonderful person who has the right to be as rich as you want.
You may have been in a car accident and don't have insurance, and that's why you're in debt. Somehow you're still morally inferior.
Well, you know, the bankruptcy.
God would have protected your car if you were a good person.
People should remember, this is one of my favorite things, the Mortgage Bankers Association of America, you know, which has decried the immorality of strategic defaults, itself walked away from a $75 million loan.
That's right.
Used to purchase its headquarters in Washington. This was 2009, 2010. Yeah,
that was a delicious
idea. So, you know, it's okay for them. But when it comes down to an individual person laying out their rationale, it becomes this moral failing, this argument over the person's morality. I think people really ought to shrug that argument off and do what they think is best as long as they know the likely consequences.
Yeah, exactly. Be clear-eyed about it, but
there are real consequences for walking away from a debt. But sometimes that's your best option. It's often better than paying off, you know, spending the rest of your life in debt servitude.
Coming up next, we talk to Wisconsin Democratic Representative Mark Bocan about the TPP and all of its attendant controversies. So stay tuned. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at SoThatHappened@HuffingtonPost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. Arthur, so?
So I went to Mark Pocan's office with our producer, Ibrahim Balki, and we talked to Mark Pocan about the TPP.
How did that go?
I thought it went really great. Let's have a listen.
Big legislation that everyone's talking about right now is the fast-tracking of a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. You're one of the majority of Democrats who's
very against this
in the House of Representatives, even though President Obama really loves it and wants it to happen. So there could be a vote as soon as this week. McCarthy's office was saying, you know, we've posted the legislation. Stay tuned. It sounds like a fluid situation. They need like 20-something Democrats to get behind it. Are you getting any lobbying And who's doing it, if so?
Yeah, I mean, the folks who are undecided are the ones who are under tremendous pressure right now because, you know, the White House is calling people up, secretaries are calling people up, generals are calling people up, people are getting flights on Air Force One. I mean, yeah, this is an all-out push on those few undecided people on one side, and on the other side, you know, labor and environmental and consumer groups are pushing people too. So to be undecided is not a great place to be right now because you're under tremendous pressure. I think that, you know, we've got the vast majority of House Democrats who are opposed to giving fast track authority for a lot of different reasons. And the Republicans are showing bravado that they have the votes, but I don't know if you watched my Magic Monday this week, I explained bravado through a magic trick.
Yeah.
Because I'm starting to wonder if it's real, because as of yesterday, a deal between our leader and the speaker kind of fell apart. The speaker still talked about the deal today, and then the article I saw this afternoon on Politico was they're basically saying a trade deal could fall apart because of Dems or something. They're trying to pass blame almost, uh-huh. And yet at the same time, they're claiming they have the votes. So, you know, if this thing passes, it will be by the narrowest of margins. But I'm not fully convinced, unless we lose a number of the Republican votes that have told us they're voting with us. I know the Democratic votes are solid where we're at, and there's a very small number of undecided people.
Now, as a firmly decided member, have you got a window into what's going on? Do you see any moving parts on the agreement? For instance, there was the slavery piece.
Mm-hmm.
In the Senate that had become controversial. Do you see anything moving around?
The big controversy right now is around the funding on the trade adjustment assistance, the TAA portion. We're being told that they would like to separate it out because some of their members want to take a separate vote on it, but it has to move. TAA and TPA have to move, and they don't want to amend it to go back to the Senate. So the funding source for the trade adjustment assistance right now is, among other things, a $700 billion cut to Medicare. And clearly, Democrats don't support cutting Medicare, and that's become a real lightning rod. So I think, you know, the vast majority of Democrats, again, are going to vote against that, if not nearly all the Democrats will vote against that. And a lot of Republicans don't like TAA, the Trade Adjustment Assistance. So the question is, if they can't get the votes then, because even their team who might support the TPA, the fast track proposal, won't support this, they may have to try to merge them again to see if that can bring in some more conservative votes. So there's a lot of moving parts, and even though in a few minutes we have a Rules Committee meeting to talk over some of the amendments that we're going to try to do to the process, I'm not sure this thing is at all in stone.
And we've certainly seen Republicans show bravado on votes before.
Exactly.
As a strategy.
Yeah.
Has Elizabeth Warren been a voice within the Democratic caucus on the House side recently?
She's been a great voice. You know, I just actually did a press conference with her on debt-free college a few hours ago. But I think, you know, she's been one of the most articulate folks on taking a relatively complex subject like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement and trying to make it a little more simple. And I think one of the points that she's really driven home that is helping a lot on getting opposition to the fast-track proposal is the fact that this is 3 years, and unless there's affirmative vote of Congress, 6 years authority for any president on any trade deal. So this isn't about this president and this trade deal, but, you know, President Scott Walker,
right?
God forbid, or the next president even, are going to get trade authority under this single vote that we could have this week. And I think that scares a lot of people because it goes really broad and is really taking away our constitutional oversight for many potential years.
Another piece of this I've heard you're vocal about is the mediation of lawsuits internationally. Is that something that's fluid at all, or is, you know, is it baked in there?
It is baked in as solid as any multinational corporation could bake it in there.
Okay.
But I think that that's an issue where across party lines, people have a problem with giving up our sovereignty. So essentially the ISDS provisions, the investor state dispute settlement provision, creates a three-person tribunal to decide cases where if a multinational corporation in Malaysia decides that if San Francisco raises their minimum wage and that affects their ability to make a profit, they can sue for lost profits. So that while it's not a direct regulatory lawsuit, in effect it is, because by doing monetary damages, they're trying to affect the regulatory environment. Only corporations and other governments have access to this for this tribunal made up of three corporate lawyers who on Monday work for a corporation, Tuesday and Wednesday they're the fair arbitrators of the law, and on Thursday they're back on the corporate payroll. I think I can tell you how most of those are going to come out. And if those provisions were as strong as they say they need to have this special tribunal in place, why wouldn't you have that in place for labor law or environmental law? We just had a labor deal we dealt with where we had a violation, and it took 6 years in Guatemala to deal with. But, you know, for a multinational corporation, they have a special process, and that just seems wrong. It affects our sovereignty, and there's Democrats and Republicans who don't support that provision.
Is there anything happening right now politically that I didn't ask about that you want to bring to light?
Yeah, the big thing is just, you know, where the bravado ends and the reality begins on the votes. You know, there's going to be a lot of, I think, promises and horse trading by leadership and by the White House, by Republican leadership in the White House, to try to get the votes they need. But you're asking, you know, Republicans to give a blank check to the president they've been complaining about for years. You're asking Democrats to support a trade agreement that doesn't have protections for labor and for the environment, has those tribunals in place, and it covers so many areas from food safety to intellectual property that, you know, there's a lot of reasons to maybe not want to give away your ability to amend or to debate a trade agreement. And I think there's a lot of things that still make it difficult for them to get the votes lined up, and we're going to do everything we can to try to make it as difficult as possible in the next week or two.
All right, Congressman Mark Pocan, thank you so much for talking to us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
On next week's podcast, we're going to show you Mark Pocan's card trick that he did. It was really, kind of changed my life because I've seen a lot of card tricks. And, you know, I'm sort of jaded about card tricks, but this one was different and I think it'll change.
This sounds great, because what better way to talk about a card trick than in a completely auditory medium?
Sounds awesome. I'm really psyched.
Yeah, you might be skeptical of the format, but I promise you it's going to be great.
It's going to change the way you think about space and time.
We're all about, like, completely trying to take the axis of your existence and bend it back in your favor. It means you might stumble around.
We're disrupting both podcasts and magic, okay?
We're an ideas festival. There's no doubt about that. Thank you, guys. What a day. What a podcast. Again, I'm joined by Zach Carter. You can follow him on Twitter at Zach D. Carter, ZachDCarter.
H is in Hammer, which is like my nickname.
Zach Hammer Carter.
Yeah, for my pants.
And Arthur Delaney. He is at Arthur Delaney, HP.
H as in
Hammer.
If I don't get more Twitter followers, I'll cut my head off with a chainsaw.
That's what H stands for? That's a lot of heavy lifting for H to do. But okay. Please follow Arthur on Twitter so he does not self-decapitate. You know, someone last week I want to give a shout out to someone last week who said that, like, the podcast was good, but we ended kind of gloomy. I hope that person could take some joy at the thought of Arthur being so despondent about Twitter that he chainsaws his own head off.
I need more followers, man.
I feel like that's like
Arthur has more followers than I do. Just in
that
the,
doesn't
in the cause
mean
of,
anything
in the cause of optimism here. I have never once considered cutting off any part of my body due to the number of followers I have.
Yeah, well,
all right.
Much less with a chainsaw.
You don't have that many followers, do you?
No.
One of these days we'll end on an upbeat, non-weird note. But today's not that day. Thanks for listening, and we miss you already. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon, and assistance from Christine Canetta and Adriana Ucero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, and Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Arthur Delaney. We'd like to thank Volvo for their generous sponsorship. Check out what Volvo can do for you at volvocars.com/US. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Check us out in the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, as always, please send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, we thank you so much for listening, and we miss you already. Boom, snap. Okay, thank you.